Whether it be trauma or a medical resuscitation, we talk a lot about how we work our way through the primary and secondary survey. And based on name alone, it would seem that the primary survey is the first thing in a resuscitation, the first thing we're going to do, the first thing we're going to dedicate our time to, and thus it deserves a ton of our focus. But when does the resuscitation actually start? To discuss this, I want to welcome Cliff Reed, emergency physician and pre-hospital specialist for Sydney HEMS, to the program. Cliff, great to have you.
Thanks, Swami. It's great to be here.
So, Cliff, back in 2018, you and a number of friends of the program, including Simon Carley and Scott Weingart, published an article entitled Zero Point Survey, a multidisciplinary idea to step up resuscitation effectiveness. Now, what is the Zero Point Survey? It's not a term that I am familiar with. And why is this concept so important in resuscitation?
Well, we've all experienced a resuscitation that felt messy or didn't go totally according to plan, right? My colleagues and I have been analyzing cases like that for years to try and figure out the factors that make things feel harder than they really should be. Now, sometimes it's just because the patient's too damn sick, but you know, most of the time, it's not actually the patient, it's us. Something about the way we manage ourselves or our teams or even the environment we're working in and the way we communicate and progress the next steps along in the resuscitation. Some of these things are just less than ideal. And if you combine these factors, when one or more of them goes wrong, that can conspire to turn anything from a mildly untidy resus to a total chicken bomb or even a clusterfuck. The great thing is that there are simple solutions to these issues, but it's best if you can preempt them as early as possible, you know, preferably before you start treating the patient. So although we've all been teaching the primary survey for years as the initial step in resuscitation, that's not really when things start for most of us, because time zero on the clock in terms of when you can start preparing for the big one, you know, might be when the call comes in from EMS, or even when you start your shift that day. As soon as you know you might be resuscitating, that's the zero point on the clock. And that's when you conduct a survey of all the correctable factors that relate to yourself and your own preparation, how you get your team ready, how you prepare your environment, before you get any eyes or hands onto the patient. So that's the zero point survey.
Cliff, in the article, you and your co-authors established the mnemonic Step Up as a frame for the zero point survey and how it flows into the primary survey. Let's go through each part of this, starting with S for self.
S for self.
Yeah, so self-preparation refers to both physical and psychological preparedness. And the physical stuff means being fit to do your job that day. But it also means simple things like emptying your bladder, making sure you're not hungry. And we can use the I'm safe checklist as a reminder. This comes from aviation, and that stands for illness, medication, stress, alcohol and other drugs, fatigue, and of course, eating and elimination. That's your physical preparedness. The psychological preparedness is about getting into the performance zone, accessing the right mental state, and interpreting what you're going to have to do as a challenge rather than as a threat. Reminding yourself that you have the resources to deal with this. You have the training, you have the kit, you have the team. And that this positive threat challenge appraisal, as it's called, that can eliminate the harmful effects of your stress response and allow you to focus and to perform. Now, it's Mike Lauria who's done most of the work on this, and we use his BTS, Beat the Stress, mnemonic, which stands for Breathe, Talk, See. Breathing alludes to the controlled breathing or combat breathing, bringing your autonomic nervous system under control. Talk is the positive self-talk, where you tell yourself, I can do this, I've got the training, I've got the resources, and we recommend you do that in your head, out loud. And then C is visualization, you know, something that's employed by top sports people, seeing in your mind's eye a successful resuscitation or successful procedure. And this has been shown to enhance performance in multiple domains. So that's S for self.
It's incredible how many of those pieces are so important, but often neglected. Drinking the day before a shift, if you're working early, can really affect how you perform, even if it's just one or two drinks. It really can have a big effect. And of course, we're not talking about drinking on shift. That's another issue for another time. And I remember that when I was training, one of the people I really looked up to in terms of their clinical acumen, their clinical medicine, as soon as we got a call from EMS saying they were bringing in a patient, the first thing he would do would be to go to the bathroom. That was the first thing he did. Take care of myself, make sure I'm in a place where I'm ready to run a team, run a resuscitation. And for him, that started with elimination. And I do think it's really important because if you have a full bladder, Cliff, it is really hard to focus on what you're doing, what's in front of you.
Oh man, yeah, it's so distracting. And you know what? In retrieval medicine, it's a nightmare because you might have done a 2-hour flight to the middle of nowhere and then you're in the bush trying to resuscitate someone. And if you haven't paid attention to those factors, they really will distract you.
T for team.
All right, let's move on to the next letter. That's T for team.
Okay, so to get your team ready, you obviously need to nominate a leader and to establish the roles. And if you have the time, you use any information you have to brief the team on what you expect to do. Share the model of what needs to be done. That's the task work mental model. And who's going to do it? That's the teamwork mental model. So who's the boss? What are the roles? And what can we anticipate we may have to do?
I think, again, this is really important. We've seen some recent literature coming out saying that maybe the leader of the team isn't as important. I know there was a med student study looking at resuscitations in a sim center where they found that these impromptu teams gathering did better than the one that had a leader. I'm not sure, though, that I buy it in terms of these high-level resuscitations. You really do need somebody who is running the show, not from the perspective of everyone defers to that person, but more from the perspective of the organization of that resuscitation and how it's going to get run.
Yep, completely agree.
E for environment.
All right, let's get to the E. That's for environment.
Of all of them, this is the one I like the most. And the reason is I've never seen this bit taught. So sometimes you get some human factors items taught on different life support courses, and they'll pay lip service to some of the self-preparation and certainly cover a lot of the teamwork. But no one ever really teaches a structured approach to preparing your environment. And that's because we expect the environment to be unchanging and standardized. In aviation human factors, the cockpit is standardized. The switches don't move and the seats are always in the same place and so on. But the resus room, there's kit that can get around and can move around, and ultrasound machines and video laryngoscopes and their cables and all this sort of stuff can get in the way. So I really adapted this from pre-hospital care, because our environment in pre-hospital care, by definition, is always different. And if we don't control the environment will control us. The best pre-hospital providers, the most experienced paramedics, have been demonstrated to differ from their novice counterparts by being the best at controlling their resuscitative real estate. That's what they call it. This is my real estate. They establish and control their workspace. And you can do this in the resus room of an ED. Even more important, say, if you're on a medical emergency team responding to crash calls within the hospital. And the way we break down environment is you need enough space, enough light, not too much, but enough heat, avoid noise, and establish crowd control. So my own little mental checklist is space, light, heat, noise, crowd. And the most important one really is space. You need 360 degrees of access around a sick patient that a team is trying to resuscitate. And it's amazing how there's just this gravitational pull of clutter and people that will suck things into that space and get in the way. And that creates its own hazards, a risk of collisions and sharp injuries and so on. So space, light, heat, noise, crowd. And we've all seen those crazy resuscitations, especially in pediatric resuscitation, where you have 10 times the number of people that you actually need all standing around that bed space. So we've got to preempt this stuff and proactively establish and control our workspace. That's E for environment.
It's almost the ergonomics of the resuscitation. I remember seeing some slides from Zach Shiner and Joe Belezzo talking about how they run their cardiac arrest resuscitations. And a lot of it is in the exact positioning, where the bed's going to enter into the room, where the transfer is going to take place and in which direction it's going to take place, where the ultrasound lives, where the person who's going to be cannulating stands. A lot of these things seem silly, but we've all been caught in that situation where the ultrasound is on the wrong side of the bed, and that completely changes how you can run that resuscitation until you fix it. So you're right. I think we ignore the environment far too much, and I think we need to pay a little bit more attention to it. And again, this is something that we often need to pay attention to way before the patient is coming in. Changing how much light is there, where the ultrasound machine should be, where the monitor should be. These simple things that often get lost.
P for patient.
Cliff, let's move to the next letter, which is P for patient.
Yeah, so this is a reminder that some of the things we sort out before the patient arrives, and then some of the things, the update and priorities after the patient arrives. So here's where we get to the patient. Now we are allowed to do the primary survey, which for years has been drummed into us that this is the first thing you do. But now we can get hands on the patient and establish those clinical priorities. So that's why P for patient is there.
U for update, P for priorities.
Let's move to the U and P for up, which stands for updates and priorities.
So let's say we've begun and maybe completed our primary survey. This is when we want to update the team. So let's get everyone on the same page, share the mental model of where we are and where we want to go. So the update is, okay, team, we have an N-year-old patient who's presented with X and primary survey reveals they are likely to have Y. That's the update. And the priorities now is let's establish an airway, good vascular access, some fluid resuscitation, and I want this patient in the CT scanner within the next 15 minutes. The whole team knows the deal and what the plan is. And then we can break down those specific tasks into sub-teams. But the key thing and the key role for the team leader is to keep going back with that shared model, with that update. And the more you do that, the more you find problems just go away. It's when people aren't on board with the plan or have no idea what's really going on or what you're thinking. That's when things start to get out of control and that resuscitation room entropy starts to grow. So the update and priorities is so important.
I can see how it's really important because especially even if you get this call from your pre-hospital team telling you what's coming in, things change from the time that they call to the time the patient arrives. And so you might have prepped your team and said, here's what we've got, here's what I expect. Patient hits the door and everything changes. We see this so many times. And so cycling back through that update and saying, now that we know this information, here's the next steps. Our priorities have now changed. And 5 minutes later, they may change again. And you talked about how you break your larger team up into sub-teams. If one of those sub-teams has been focused on a specific task, they might look up from that task and not really understand what else has been going on in the room, making that update so important to bring that team back in, again, like you said, to that shared mental model, and then repurpose them to another task if they finish their first one. So I'm assuming, again, you talked about how this isn't a linear process, but you're going to be cycling through that UNP multiple times during that resuscitation until you've really had the patient leave your service and go to somebody else.
That's right. And you know what? I've emphasized the role of the team leader in providing the update, but it's everyone in the team's responsibility to see that it happens. And in simulation, I'll often stop and point to one of the doctors or nurses on the team and say, do you know what's going on? And they'll say no. And I say, why didn't you ask for an update? Can I do that? Of course you can. It's like, hey, team leader, any chance we can have a quick summary of where we are and where we're going, please? Anybody in the team can ask that. And that's helpful for everybody else.
And do you also do this when your consultants come into the room? Because often we're starting the resuscitation and then maybe our trauma team comes in or our ICU team comes in. Are you then going back and giving everybody an update so that everybody has that mental model of where we are and what's next?
Yeah, it's really helpful for the whole team to be brought onto the same page at the same time.
S for self, T for team, E for environment, P for patient, U for update, P for priorities.
All right, while many of us might not be doing this formally, Cliff, aren't we all incorporating this into our resuscitations already? I guess my question is, do we need to deliberately apply the 0-point summary, or is this something that we've already integrated and we've simply given a name to what we've already done?
Well, many people are doing this already, and those of us that put together the paper to describe the 0-point survey were really trying to put our heads together to work out why everyone isn't doing it, why we're all doing it a different way, and why we don't have a common language for this. Because everyone in the world knows what a primary survey is and how to do it. And we just wanted to provide some structure to this and a memorable way of performing it and teaching it. You know, it's a great question saying, isn't everybody already doing this? I bet that's what people said about the primary survey when it first came out. So the ZPS, that does the same thing. That gives a memorable and easily teachable structure to what the really good resuscitationists are doing already. And if we can practice it together in simulation and in actual resuscitations, then we do have this common language for preparing together and also for troubleshooting together when things go wrong. The step up is a great debrief structure as well, because the more the team is on the same page during a resus, the better that's got to be for our patients.
Summary.
Cliff, we're going to drop a link to the article that you guys published in the show notes so people can look at this. It's a short read, but I do think it's really important. I think, again, if we frame this as 0-point survey, primary survey, secondary survey, and people just keep in their mind, okay, I've gotten a call. I know a patient's coming in. I know I'm going to be running a resuscitation. Let's go through these things first before that patient hits the door. If they simply get to that point, it's really going to change the way the resuscitations run. All of a sudden, you see that calm, very collected team going through a little bit more methodically in that resuscitation. And anytime you've watched a resuscitation run where you thought, wow, this room is quiet and everyone just seems to be working in harmony, I guarantee you that they had this moment before, even if it was only parts of this, they had this moment before the patient hit the door, or else it just doesn't run as smoothly. So I think go over, check out that article from Cliff, from Scott, from Simon, and the rest of their colleagues, and try this the next time that you're on shift, that you're running one of these resuscitations. Take a little bit of time before that patient hits the door to get your team together, to get yourself prepared, to set your environment up in a way that is going to be useful for you. And then, of course, don't forget to update your team to make sure that you still have the same set of priorities and change those priorities as the patient's status changes. And tell us how you think that runs, because I think you're going to find a much better experience. Cliff, thanks so much for coming on and discussing this with us.
Thank you, my friends. It's an absolute pleasure.